In the void, no one can hear you scream, which is why we gotta make so much Emperor damned noise on the Pirate Vox waves. We are the Banshee Whale of Truth and Justice, 665.66 UHMR Chemrat Radio. Coming to you live tonight from Mama Kaz's Noodle House, home of the hottest ramen and best views of the Denlay Divide.
Gotta love Mama Kaz's with a couple of those off-world spices and some frostbats. Good news for any of you Arco hunters. The Marshals have upped the bounty payouts on tips leading to relics and artifacts in the Underhive. Seems like the Shadowbreakers just can't seem to get their hands on the Inquisition's new toys. In other news, a man was executed on the spot at the Carastus Weapons Manufactorum after he went on a rampage attacking several line workers before partially devouring the line foreman's face.
Some people just don't know the limits when it comes to Sumpa Spy.
The only mind-altering substance you need, I am your friendly neighborhood plasma fiend, Goblin King, joined today by the mind-melting maestro of madness, Marky.
Suppose.
And keeping those ice tracks as thawed as his heart is frozen, it's the polar bear himself, Sugarfly.
Just to remind all of you, no matter how much you take or how little you take, wherever you go, there you are.
I thought he was gonna say, like,
that's fucking profound, man.
Yeah, I was thinking he's gonna be like, wherever you go, wherever, whatever you're thinking, I'm inside of you. And I'm just like, okay.
I got my razor paws deep in your guts.
Boy. Not in, well, up inside your guts.
When we set out a roadmap for our coverage of the Horus Heresy, we had set it as only 6 episodes, splitting the events down into 3 sections, the early years, the middle years, and finally the confrontation on Terra. It was only after digging much deeper into the source material that the full weight of the task that we set to ourselves completely settled in.
You know,
Marky's map here.
it's been a wild ride for sure. I lost a lot of, all right. So first things first, I didn't realize how much respect I was going to lose for the Emperor when we started this series. That's first and foremost. All right. I didn't realize that he was such a cock.
I'm burning somebody's house.
I was just going to be like this fucking guy. And I didn't realize that I was going to gain respect.
Dad at the dinner table.
I didn't realize I was going to gain respect for some of the Space Marine chapters, except for the Dark Angel. Sorry, Dark Angel players. If you're a Dark Angel player, I apologize. I don't. Fuck you guys. Dark Angels, I don't know. They're just not my thing, man. They're not my bag.
Like, the progress of the podcast has been shitting on the Ultramarines to shitting on the Dark Angels.
Why aren't you liking them, Marky? Like, what is it?
Because they're the... All right, so, like, if the Emperor is the cock, they're like the pubic hair on the side of the cock that doesn't belong there. Sorry, like, Dark Angels players. I don't mean it.
Just like a wild one, yes, like, growing on a mole or something? What you're talking about?
Not even a mole. There's not even a mole there. It's just random pubic hair.
Like the one you have to.
Yeah, you gotta like pluck. You're like, why are you even growing there?
The fuck did this happen?
You pluck it from the Imperium and you just kind of throw it in the trash.
Wow.
Sorry, Dark Angels players.
I have no idea whether or not his feelings of the Dark Angels players are gonna share. Dark Angels, not players, but Dark Angels are gonna change this episode, but we'll find out.
I doubt it.
Wow.
Now that the complete book series of the Horus Heresy has come to an end with the most recent Black Library release, The End and the Death, Volume 3, there are 64 volumes that make up the 9-year conflict. Additionally, there are 21 releases from short stories to full novels on the Primarchs and their origins, which are also considered part of the Horus Heresy. There are 3 books focusing on other major Space Marine characters who are not Primarchs, 24 novellas written, and a novella is written fiction that is longer than a short story, but shorter than a novel, think like 100 to 120 pages, that just deal with the heresy itself. And there are 3 more books that deal with the Siege of Terra specifically that are not part of the Siege of Terra books. And then there are 45 independent audio dramas, which brings the total Black Library releases just for the heresy era to a total of 160. That's without looking at the codexes or the core rule books or the omnibuses or the anthologies. which if it's in an omnibus or in an anthology and it exists alone, I didn't count it. As a comparison, there are only 12 books in the Beast Arises series, 9 books about the Adaptus Sororitas in total, 4 books about the Dark Eldar, 3 about the Gene Stealer cults. I think you guys get the idea. The full Black Library contains about 583 releases in the 30K and 40K world. I tossed out all of the Warhammer Old World, and I tossed out any books that were written before Black Library was the Black Library. And this does not include, again, the anthologies and the omnibuses, which combine a bunch of the short stories or put a bunch of the stuff together. That means that the Horus Heresy releases alone make up 27% of all fiction currently written about the 40K universe, which is kind of insane when you consider it's 9 years long.
The thing that gets me is, like, to me, the Horus Heresy is, like, probably some of the most boring, and this is going to be a hot take, probably some of the most boring content to me, personally, because it's Space Marine on Space Marine action drama.
Yeah.
Where 40K leans into like Xenos and demons and at least a lot more, right? Where it's like, that's way more interesting, and like, and guard and humans, like, I don't know, 30K just does not interest me as much. There are like, so the thing about me is like every week when I would play 40K with the guys, right? Tom would read a book or watch a video and he'd kind of like give me the cliff notes of lore. And that's kind of how my brain operates, right? I need the cliff notes, because if you go into like some long tangent about, you know, the bolt size of a Lehman Russ's undercarriage, I'm going to flip out on you. And it's
28.2 grams torque things. At 38 pounds.
You're not into all the little things.
Yeah, like I really don't care like how many threads were in the fucking tapestry of the emperor's fucking cock cloth. Like I don't
you seem to have gathered more enjoyment and more knowledge out of our research and then our 100%. Full episodes
100%.
On heresy stuff than you had before. Cause you were like, oh, this battle's dope. And I'm like, yeah, cause I didn't spend 400 pages to explain it.
His boot slowly squished probably isn't the, you know, the verbiage that they use.
Yeah. The way that Samuelis's boot crunched the gravel as he walked down Main Street, considering the impact that the Space Marines had had on the most recent conquest of 77914, so, made Horus think about the dinner his mom made him 17 years ago on a green hill next to a winding river named after a snake that the emperor found as a boy in ancient Egypt. You're like, what the fuck does any of this have to do with the battle this book is supposed to be
about? I'm
going to
blow my brains out, dude. Just that alone, like, it's like PTSD, dude. Like, you're bringing me back, and I'm like, oh my God, I'm going to fucking...
Put me in the book. So, put me in
Marky,
the book.
I'm fucking kill Marky, myself. So in Marky's view, he's kind of like... who's the crazy corn guy?
I'm dumb.
The crazy corn. What crazy corn guy? Karn the Betrayer?
Karn the Betrayer. So he's like Karn the Betrayer in the books. The Remembrancers never get it right.
Yeah.
They make it too gaudy. They don't capture the true, you know, dirt of what's really going on. Marky'd rather have the dirt or not the pretty shiny parts.
Yeah. Part of that is that that's what the Remembrances were there for. So there was a book. So back in the day, like I'm a relatively big Tolkien fan. I'm a relatively big fantasy novel fan. So at some point, a teacher suggested, that's the word, not successed, that I read a book called Ivanhoe. And Ivanhoe is, I couldn't get through more than like a quarter of it. So I couldn't really tell you, but it's essentially like a fantasy-esque or fantasy-adjacent novel.
At some
novel.
Point, you're like, I don't care about Ivan or his hoe. It's just, well, can we get to the good part?
The first chapter was the description of a hillside that, like, sheep were grazing on. And I get that Tolkien used a lot of imagery in his novels, but when the imagery builds the picture that I'm interested in, I'm okay with it. when the imagery that's being used describes, like, you could have just said green grass hill with sheep on it, and I would have been good. But you literally spent 15 pages describing the shades of green. And I brought this opinion to the teacher at the time, and the teacher's like, that's the point. And I'm like, no, it's really not. Like, I do from a like education and literature and writing perspective, I do understand the value and the lesson that you're trying to teach me. But I'm trying to give you feedback that I didn't need this lesson as somebody who reads as much as I do, one. And two, this is not something that I want to do for enjoyment.
Yeah. Like, that's 15 minutes of my life I'm never going to get back. Like, that's 15 minutes of me not, like, I literally could have just reread The Hobbit
and been happy. Yeah. But you were like, read this other classic book. It's up your alley. And it's not up my alley. It's like Andy Warhol. I don't like Andy Warhol's art. I understand the contribution that Andy Warhol made as a pop artist to the art world. I understand that his methods changed stuff. I understand that he had an impact and value on society. I also don't like his art. And I'm allowed to have both of those things. Yeah. And that's another thing. When I was in art school, one of my art teachers got super fucking mad at me that I didn't, that I didn't like Andy Warhol. And I was like, why do I have to, I don't have to like something to appreciate its impact on society. Like,
because you didn't do cocaine.
As an example.
It's like, as an example, you know, not everybody can appreciate it.
Right.
Oh, but I can.
It's like, fuck metal, not everybody can appreciate it. I don't necessarily enjoy or like visceral car accidents. I understand they have an impact on society, like, and I don't understand why, like, when it's an innocuous thing like art or a book, people get really mad at you for not liking it, and you're like, dude, I just don't like it. Like,
yeah. I see.
Marky doesn't know how to read. I got it.
Yeah, 100%. That entire conversation was about me not liking books, which we've discussed every time I've been on an episode. Is that I don't read, and that it's bad for me. You can tell by my horrific vocabulary that I don't read books.
He kind of reads the notes. I'm not sure he reads the scripts, but he kind of reads the notes.
Yeah, there's a reason that we go on tangents and stuff, and it's because I am a creature of chaos.
I thought that was because we were podcasters.
That could be it too.
He's a creature of chaos for sure. He's that lowly demon.
I really
demonette.
Like corn after our last game.
There you go. I like corn too. That's why I live in the no. Yeah. That's not really what you meant. You didn't mean
really wrong, love corn wrong tortillas. Corn.
Sorry. No. Sorry. I thought you meant like corn as in like, you know, corn.
I love them both.
To do the lore full justice and not rush over some of the cooler battles and lore elements, our roadmap changed from those original six episodes, with some of the bigger battles of the early heresy covered in full. As you guys know, we went ahead and looked at those as multi-part series. So now we're going to kind of go back and look at the timeline of events to make up some of those early periods and fill in some of the gaps that we've left in the story so far. With that in mind, welcome to episode 104, The Horus Heresy, The Coming Storm, Part 1.
Sit down, strap on, and hug your loved ones.
Get a cup of coffee. Get ready to take notes, because, man, look at this timeline. By the way, if you haven't already, you can join us for $3, $6, or $9 and see the pictures we bring up that we refer to sometimes. And so, she's fine.
So what is this timeline? This is based on the books? How everything ties together?
It's fucked is what it is.
This is the order in which to read. This is the suggested order in which to read the books.
Oh, fuck that.
No, Chuck, you got to do this.
You read them in the order they came out, just like the Marvel movies.
Exactly. And this is just the 52 releases that were available at the time this infographic was made.
All right, serious question. When you watch Star Wars, what movie do you start with?
Four, A New Hope.
Agreed.
Who doesn't start with Four, A New Hope? What are you talking about, Martin? There are only three Star Wars movies. A New Hope, The Empire Strikes Back, and Revenge of the Jedi. Or Revenge of the... Return to the Jedi.
So, like, for some reason, I'm
man, I broke have Chuck. To. I apparently said an old guy thing.
I have to start at like
oh
on
my
time.
God.
Like, I have to watch it like on a timeline basis. So, like, I start with episode one?
I've watched it all the way through from episode one. I've watched episode one to episode six.
I just watch whatever fucking one I want to watch.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever watched episode one to episode nine. There's a machete order. There's an order you're supposed to watch them in for some reason, and I never understand why the machete order is not the same as the order they were released in, but whatever.
Yeah, I mean, it's like prequel order they're numbered stuff, in. You know. Sometimes they release prequels and shit. People want to know what happened before, which is understandable for like characters like Darth Vader and whatnot. Not going to get into it. Different universe. We're talking about the new Darth Vader, the Emperor of Mankind.
Whoa.
So apparently the Machete Order is A New Hope, Return of the Jedi, Rogue One, Attack of the Clones, Revenge of the Sith, Solo, Empire Strikes Back, Phantom Menace, and then The Force Awakens. And then there's one more. And then The Last Jedi.
I actually didn't mind Solo. Rogue One, I liked one of the top movies for me.
Oh my God, Rogue One is amazing.
I
heard Andor is really good too.
I tried watching Andor. Yeah, a little slow for me. I'm also not the biggest Star Wars fan. Yeah.
Rogue One. Andor was all right. Yeah, Rogue One was awesome. It was like, I have to watch it again. Like, if I was going to buy a DVD, I wouldn't buy it.
Got you.
You mean a Blu-ray?
If
I was going to get a VHS.
If I was going to buy it on Laserdisc.
if it's on Channel 13 in the middle of the afternoon with commercials, I have nothing to do, sure, I'll watch it and fall asleep.
It's fine, Chuck, because I think I'm wrong too, because at this point I think you just buy digital, right? You don't even buy Blu-rays. Like, people buy digital.
No, you were incorrect. Actually, you do buy the Blu-rays, and then you get the little QR code. My son just learned this the other day. And then you get the digital copy, so you just buy it and...
How did you not know that 10 years ago?
How the fuck did you guys not know that, Chuck?
I knew that, but we didn't have the thing on the TV, but you should have heard him the other night. And then some of them have dates that you have to do it by, and he was actually uploading them, and they were past the date. But then he bought a brand new one today of a brand new movie, and it was past the date and won't let him do it. He's like, well, I'm just fucking returning the movie then.
Damn right. What the fuck, man?
I got to look at the dates now on everything I buy. I'm like, Jesus Christ.
Yeah, you're right. Just like food. Come on.
I have a confession.
Oh, God.
So before Ryan breaks into this next area, I've bought at least 6 copies of Starship Troopers on digital.
I think I bought it at least
3 times.
One of your favorite, if not your favorite. So I understand that. Like, I don't judge you.
No, I take that back. I think I've bought it 4 times because I bought it on VHS.
I judge you for other reasons, but not
I
for that.
I bought it on I bought it on DVD and I bought it on Blu-ray because I own it on Blu-ray now.
Yep.
And I know for a fact that when I had a Laserdisc collection, I had it on Laserdisc. So that's 4.
Dude,
have a Laserdisc
collection. I could find my VHS version of Starship Troopers. Oh, I gotta go raid my mom's garage again. See if I can
just
watch
it on like horrible grainy static.
No, just to have it like a collector's item.
I got the original
like Dragon Ball series in VHS. It's like Roots, dude. It's got like it's a whole box. It's like it's like a 1 foot by 6 inch just block of shit that I'll never use.
I have the original Shogun on DVD. So Shogun came out maybe 60s, 70s. They did the show Shogun, the show that they're getting ready to release again right now. And on DVD it's like 9 DVDs. I think it's the biggest DVD set that I have, because instead of being like the Pacific or Band of Brothers where it's like a tin and they're all stacked on each other, it's 9 individual DVD boxes next to each other. So it's like that much. You're like, Jesus, man, like why not put them all in, you know, why not double side them or something? Come on.
What you're saying is, if GW ever puts this on Warhammer Plus as movies and then releases it, you need your own filing cabinet.
I'm gonna have my own filing cabinet. That's right.
Have you guys not to keep taking us even further into left field, but I'm gonna do it. You guys have seen
I know Roots, that's you,
right?
I know.
Yes.
Yeah. So I watched that as like a 9-year-old.
And it messed you up?
No. So it was so good. So it's like 9 it's like 8 or 9 VHS tapes.
That's Roots. A relatively good,
Yeah.
It's very well done.
It was so good. As a 9-year-old kid, I watched the whole thing all the way through. And Titanic was 2 VHS tapes. So like, I could barely get through that as a kid.
Dude, I remember that.
You could tell how often I was left alone in a house doing nothing because it was just movies constantly. Just putting on movies, watching movies, Starship Troopers, Silence of the Lambs.
Marky was raised Titanic. By TV.
Yeah. Oh,
I love it.
I 100% was raised by my VHS player. But it's all right. It made me the great man I am today.
Speaking of, are you going to let me get back to that?
Yeah. Speaking of great men. Yeah. Let's get back to Ryan.
Emperor himself.
Most of the heresy is focused on the Space Marines, both loyalists and traitors, along with the forces that serve them. And as we've mentioned while reading the novels, it can get a bit stale and samey, since it really seems like at times the only thing that changes is their armor color. Because of that, we had tried to design this series to cover a lot of these events as an overview, while choosing some of the more important battles to deep dive into. Since so much of it centers around the Space Marine Legions, however, here is a bit of a primer on their structure, because it's kind of important and it's a lot different than how it's treated in the 41st millennium. On average, using numbers taken from the height of the Great Crusade, a legion consisted of 11 chapters, a chapter starting at 1,000 battle-line Space Marines, although often this number could grow from here. So they started around 1,000, but it could be a couple thousand pretty easily. A chapter was then split into 2 battalions, which were further subdivided into companies. A company often focused on a single combat role, like Terminators, Tactical, Outriders, etc. While the numbers here are harder to find, there were about 5 to 6 companies in a battalion, suggesting a company held between 50 to 100 Marines on average. Keep in mind, however, that the names of each of these changed by legion, and the sizes differed greatly. A chapter was also called a great company, a hero, or a millennial.
That's
the word that's used. I've just never said it out loud. And meaning a million.
Interesting. Weird.
A battalion was called a cohort, regiment, or battle group, and a company was called a maniple.
That must have been the Raven Guard.
A band or a brotherhood. Also, as we just went over, the sizes aren't set in stone, so a chapter might be 3,500 Marines split into 3 battalions, and then each of those is split into 7 companies. Just remember, on average, a chapter is 1,000 Marines and a company is 100 Marines. So when we say 2 chapters, or we name off 3 chapters, or we say something like the 577th chapter, realize that means that there are
roughly
576 other groups of 1,000 people. It kind of gives you a scale of some of these things when you actually hear the numbers involved. And obviously a lot of that translated into modern 40K as the legions are split into chapters. Chapters still maintain about 1,000 Marines. The number can go up, the number can go down. Generally speaking, it's not supposed to go up, but it usually kind of wavers a little bit. And finger a company quotes. Inside a chapter is usually about 100 Marines as well. So
yeah, which is crazy on the grand scale of things when you consider that they're, you know, a universe spanning
galaxy.
It's just they're a galaxy spanning
empire. Empire. Yeah. Yeah. Galaxy spanning empire. I knew the words you meant.
Yeah. Universe galaxy. Yeah. They go pretty far. Yeah, here's my enhanced vocabulary coming back to me. They go pretty far out into space. So there's when you think about 1,000 Marines across a whole solar system, there's probably there's probably more people in a town than planet.
Well, in 40K's timeline, there's only about 1 million Space Marines total left in the galaxy. And as Marky just said, that's 1 million.
Less than a small city.
And seeing a Space Marine is exceptionally rare. People just don't see him anymore. Now, at the height of the Great Crusade, there were probably
hundreds of thousands.
Well, there's
hundreds of millions. Hundreds of millions. Probably 100 million Marines. In the books,
they talk about, you know, the captain of the 250th. So there you go. That's the 250th captain, just like what Ryan said with the numbers. 250,000
right there, give or take.
Yeah. So there's 250,000 Marines in that legion at that point. Yeah. And there's, we'll talk about it today, there's the Imperial 5th The Imperial Fist's 79th and 556th company are dispatched to a planet. Well, that means that there's at least 500 or 456 companies of Imperial Fists. Now, of course, when a company is wiped out, that company flag, that company banner gets hung in their hall, and that company doesn't get refilled. So if 6th company is dead, it like was lost on some battlefield, they don't go, okay, company 101st, the 101st company that's founded, they don't go, okay, you're now the 6th company because the 6th company was wiped out. They still call them the 101st. So it doesn't necessarily indicate that there are 450,000 Imperial Fists, but it definitely suggests that there are more than we think there are. And there are a lot of numbers floating out around where the Space Marine numbers were by the time of the Siege of Terra, how devastated the legions had been. And even those numbers are large and impressive when you think like, you know, because they say things like only 20,000 Blood Angels survived to make it to the Siege of Terra. 20,000 Marines, Space Marines, is a lot in comparison to 41st millennium.
Yeah.
That's a huge amount of Space Marines.
Like 20 chapters in 40K.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. So it's an impressive number, but that's after the Blood Angels had been devastated over and over and over and over and over again. You know, so when they've had their size reduced by a half, 5 or 6 different times, you're like, okay, well, you know, they had 40,000, then they had 80,000, then they had 160,000. Just go up 10 times, you know, double it 10 times, and that's where they were before they started losing people or whatever. And it definitely paints a different picture is the point that we're trying to get at, I guess.
Before, so basically towards the Siege of Terra, 9 years of conflict, not how you were talking earlier in one of the other episodes about resupplying materials. It's your resupplying personnel too. You can't keep up with.
And yeah, and we'll talk today in a couple of the different events that we're going to cover about the corners they cut to try to keep up with recruitment. And what that did and what that meant. Looking at the Horus Heresy as a full timeline, while it's hard to pin down the exact start of the heresy itself, it's pretty set in stone that Horus's fall happened at the First Battle of Davin in 004.M31. This was followed by the Burning of Prospero, which also started in 004.M31. So remember, that's the 4th year of the 31st millennium. The Burning of Prospero was a conflict that would last for little over a year. Right around the same time, after he was recovered from his wounds, Horus killed Fabricator Consul Emry Salgenak of the Aturian Technocracy, a move that allowed the Sons of Horus to capture the SDC Horuses needed to appeal to Fabricator Kalbor Hall on Mars, which we covered in our Schism of Mars episode. Perturabo also ruthlessly put down the rebellion on his home planet of Olympia by completely destroying it in 004.M31. Horus dispatched the Blood Angels to the Cygnus Cluster, and they become lost on their way in 005.M31, and the Dark Angels were dispatched to the Eastern Fringes around the same time. This was also just about in line with when Magnus was broken by Leman Russ and chose to become the first demon Primarch to embrace the gifts of Tzeentch in order to save his legion. Then, as we covered in our first Horus Heresy series, came the Ishtvan III atrocity in 005.M31. And while the majority of the action happened in the first few days, the entire conflict would drag out for a little over a year. As the troops were engaged in battle down on the planet of Ishtvan, Horus was placing regicide with the legions that fell under his command, ordering the Ultramarines and the Wordbearers to muster at Kalth. The Ultramarines would move to Kalth in the Verdian system immediately, so again, about 005.M31, while the Wordbearers would lag in the Ishtvan system to set things in motion for their coming ritual known as the Ruin Storm.
It's always funny to me that they like refer to it as regicide, and I don't know if you guys ever... I'm a big... chess. Well, I wouldn't say I'm big chess guy.
Regicide is an old name for chess, basically.
Yeah, I had no idea, but they actually came out with a 40K regicide game, which is essentially just chess, but they added how do you put it, like 40K
theme
RNG
stuff
to it. Yeah, so like you're like you have Space Marine pawns and like
a,
yeah. Like, you go around, you can like move a guy here, you can throw a grenade or shoot, but it's on a chessboard. It was pretty cool. I actually really enjoyed it, but I think I just enjoyed the 40K skin over a regular chessboard. I actually really enjoyed chess. One fun fact about Marky is just...
Regicide just means king killer.
Mm-hmm.
Like, homicide means like person, like human killer, and infanticide means infant killer. And I right. can't, there's one, fratricide means brother killer. There's a bunch of asides.
Yeah, but I just always thought it was cool. I enjoyed the game of regicide. I think they actually took it off the store.
It's like Marky's Corner right now. I love it.
I know. Just bringing up random shit. Ryan's like, thank you. That's what he does, man.
I mean, at least I brought up Regicide.
He's like, I really missed you last week bringing up random, has nothing to do with the topic.
Random facts that have conversations. Nothing to do with nothing.
Yeah, thank you for talking about shit for 20 minutes, Mark. And now can I get back to the podcast? Yes, you may, Ryan.
To continue the flow here, Regulus, a magus of the Mechanicum who had fallen and sided with Horus, delivered the promise of STCs and the means to unlock the vaults of Morvec to Kalbor Hall. This essentially started the Schism of Mars in 005.M31, which we have covered in greater detail again already. Mars would fall to the Dark Mechanicum later in 006.M31, right around the time Horus launched his second big attack against the Imperium with the Dropsite Massacre of Istvan V, which we've also covered. The Dropsite Massacre allowed Erebus and Corpheron of the Wordbearers to gather ritual materials from the dead Loyalist Space Marines, which would be needed in the coming ritual known as the Ruin Storm. With Logar and the World Bearers leaving after the Dropsite Massacre to join the Ultramarines in the Viridian system at Kalth. But before the Battle of Kalth would begin in earnest, there was a handful of other major events that were taking place. That's what we're going to get into today.
Those are some of the most interesting episodes, I think.
Yeah.
To me.
We're at 3 years now into this?
Roughly. 004, 005, 006. A lot of Imperium scholars consider the beginning of the Horus Heresy to be Istvan III, which still happened in 004. It just kind of happened towards the end of 004. And we don't have, as we talked about way back at the beginning of the podcast, the year is split into 990 segments. And then the millennia, obviously, is split a thousand years, not a millennia, is split. Yeah, that's a millennia. A millennia is split into 990 years. So when we say 005.M31, that's the fifth year of the 31st millennia. So we're not giving, as we're going down these dates, we're not giving you like 176, so the 176th day of the fourth year of the 31st millennium, because we don't know that. We just know that these events happened in the fourth year, in the fifth year. And we know the order they took place in. So we know Istvan III happened before Istvan V, even though they both technically started or took place at the same time. We know that the Schism of Mars started in 005. Like, we've got the order in which the events happened, but we don't have the like exact dates, essentially. I feel like I probably could have summed that up way easier if I just said that last thing first. We're going to start off with the Battle of the Rangda System, 006.M31. The treachery at Avex Mors, also known as the Battle of the Rangda System, was the earliest known engagement of the Dark Angels in the Heresy. Earlier during the Great Crusade, the Ragnan Zeticides had been among the most catastrophic and had brought the Imperium to the brink of destruction. These conflicts were so terrible that most of the information surrounding them has been suppressed or outright destroyed in the months following the Imperium's eventual victory. Even the nature of the victory itself is hazy and is still highly disputed, with the existence of many conflicting accounts. It's rumored that around this time in the Great Crusade, the two missing or purged legions were heavily damaged, and maybe this is even the time when they vanished from Imperial record. We don't have full proof of that, and we'll actually get into the Ragdan Zenocide itself as an event when we circle back with a future series when we're done with the heresy stuff, because the Ragdan Zenocides are kind of interesting. But that's one of those little things that's dropped, one of those little Reddit arguments, if you want to say, is whether or not the second legion just was completely wiped out during the Xenocides is one of the theories. It's important to note, however, that during these wars, the Dark Angels created the Order of the Broken Claws. This was a warrior cadre that was specialized in fighting the Ragdag Xenos. While the Order's purpose was fulfilled after the Imperium's victory, as the entire Ragdan species was allegedly destroyed, it was not disbanded. Instead, they would continue to stand guard at Advex Moors, where the Ragda had first been encountered, something which had led to the planet's misidentification as the Ragdan homeworld. Advec Moors also harbored the secret knowledge and weaponry that had been related to the Ragdan and their Xenocide. The garrison also housed the 51st Dark Angels chapter, the Sable Griffins, who were tasked as the Order of the Broken Claws backups. Basically, all of these troops were just waiting for the Ragdan to return out of the black. During the first Ragdan Xenocide, they thought they had wiped them all off because they thought that this planet, Avex Moors, was the Ragdan homeworld. And then, like, a certain amount of time passed, and then the Ragdan just came out of the fringe. They came out of the deep void and attacked the planet again. And then they fought them again, and it happened, like, three times.
So someone had forethought to be, just in case, let's leave these guys here. Let's leave a garrison here.
Yeah.
Well, and I hate to leave a garrison here.
What did these Xenos look like? Do we have any descriptions on them?
We don't really have any descriptions on them. One of the pictures that pops up when you search for them are essentially what looks like they're almost enslaver looking. Is it kind of what you have pulled up right now? Yeah, they're kind of like floating torsos with three heads, two arms, and like almost a wasp-like.
They look tail. Very Nurgle-y.
Yeah, but they almost look like the engineers from Halo in a sense. I want to say.
Yeah, I'm almost positive that's just like
fan art,
a common piece of art that's attached to the word. I want to say there's a brief description of what the Rangda look like. Rangda and Ragdan. The Rangda are part of the Ragdan Empire. I want to say that there's a better description of them that we will cover during the Xenocide, but they were just essentially a pretty floating massive alien, like tyrant species that had taken over a bunch of human planets.
I'd probably want to wipe them out too, man.
The Western Fringe. What's up?
But I'd probably want to wipe them out too. You know, you wouldn't want flying nutsack species to just take over. It's like, who are your overlords? It's like these guys.
They had all of these crazy super weapons too, like doomsday level weapons that the Order of the Broken Claws were essentially, their chapter house is built on top of these vaults that contain all of this like ancient knowledge and like crazy weaponry. And that'll fast forward us to 006.M31. The Dark Angels forces at Advex Moors received a hail from the Sons of Horus heavy cruiser Conqueror's Pride, asking for a resupply. Once they hit orbit, though, the Sons of Horus launched several squadrons of Stormbirds and Storm Eagles, and all hailing queries from the Dark Angels as to their destination went unanswered. So the Dark Angels are like, hey, bros, like, these are the places you need to land. We will totally help you out. And they're just getting no answer. Eventually, Knight Raidor Cordre Mordred demanded an answer from the Sons of Horus commander, and he was met with an indiscriminate orbital bombardment. While the barrage wiped the Dark Angels' fortifications out, the chapter house of the Order of the Broken Claw was left largely undamaged. Once these outermost defenses had been crippled, the Sons of Horus gunships landed, and an entire chapter, including an entire company of Dastarian Terminators, marched out of them. The traitors wasted little time, dispatching a task force to take the astropathic nexus, while the Jastarin consul himself tore the chapter house's gates from its hinge and bellowed a challenge for the Dark Angels to come out and face him. However, the Dark Angels held, and eventually the Jastarian charged forward into the antechamber, only to trigger a massive blast that tore into the Sons of Horus and trapped them inside. It was then that the 12 surviving Dark Angels of the Order of the Broken Claws launched their ambush, falling on the 50 Jastarian Terminators. They used the pitch-black maze of the Chapter House's corridors to take the Terminators apart. And when the rubble was finally breached by the rest of the Sons of Horus forces, they were greeted by a grim mountain of their dead. The 3 surviving Dark Angels then withdrew into the lower vaults, where the relics of the Rangda were held in stasis. So, 12 Dark Angels took on 50 Terminators, killed all of them, but were reduced from 12 men to 3 men.
Yeah, I mean, kind of cool, I guess.
And they were black armored dark angels.
The Order of the Broken Claw. Yeah, they've got their own. They have their own, like, Deathwing livery.
I think they're so fucking cool because they got black armor.
I don't think they've got black armor. I don't really know if there's. I don't know if enough of the Order of the Broken Claw, like, continue exist.
They're the old.
Probably got nutsack armor or something.
It's heresy armor for the Dark Angels.
They look like those dudes from The Witcher.
Yeah, it's most likely the old black armor. But yeah, that, I mean, they don't look like Deathwing. Deathwing are here. The guys in white are here, but these are not Deathwing. This was another totally different group.
Like eggshell white. Yeah.
So instead of burning the survivors out with Promethium or Phosphex, the Sons of Horus decided to avenge the honor of their fallen Terminators in a direct assault. And this happens a lot in the Heresy. Somebody's like, oh, you beat our dudes. We're super butthurt about the fact that you beat our dudes. We're not going to do the tactically smart thing. We're going to win. We have to get into the ring and fight you.
Meh. Hell yeah, that's how you do it.
The first assault force made up of veteran Sons of Horus lasted only 10 minutes and managed to only kill one of the Dark Angels defenders. The Dark Angels essentially started to, like, use the building to their advantage. It was their building. A further three bands descended into the vaults and were pinned by another single Dark Angel, the Order of the Broken Claw, masterfully using their catacombs to create choke points and kill boxes. It was then that the message reached the rear guard of the Sons of Horus in the ruins of the chapter house above that survivors of the Dark Angels had managed to hold the core of the Astropathic Nexus, maintaining loyalist control of off-world communication. This forced the Sons of Horus to commit their destroyer squads in both attacks, and the final Dark Angel survivors gave a final salute before being consumed by Phosphex. I imagine that final salute was one finger on each hand, I'm just saying. With these locations finally secured, the traitor tech marines plundered the vaults of the Rangdan technology, which had been their original objective assigned by Horus. However, Night Praetor Mordred, his Deathwing lifeguard, and those few survivors of the Sable Griffins who were in the ruins of the fortifications made it out and made a final rally in an attempt to halt the mass exodus of the traitors and their loot. Even as in orbit, the Conqueror's Pride began another mass orbital bombardment to cover their tracks. The Dark Angels managed to capture only one Stormbird and shoot down only one other, though. They didn't really have massive success. But before the orbital bombardment could salvage enough of the wounded Pride of the Sons of Horus, they were robbed of the full chance of a more complete victory, as Night Praetor Mordred had recalled the Promethean-clad cruiser Invidious and the ancient Terran warship had arrived in system to support Advex Mors. The traitor warship was heavily outclassed and began to hastily withdraw, the Sons of Horus only managing to bloody the Dark Angels, not devastate them as planned, although the Ragda weapons had been captured, and this could turn the war in Horus's favor.
But, like, how gnarly were these weapons that, like, were they, was there any, was it noteworthy in any other war past that, like, or
we'll get back to them later. They're used, some of them are worked into the Dark Mechanicus's weapons that are used on the Siege of Terra.
I was gonna say, they gotta be bad if theory an entire chapter is wiped taking that system in theory.
So the Order of the Broken Claw, there weren't that many of them left. So the Ragdan Xenocides were bad, like that. It's difficult without doing a mini series on them, which I didn't feel we had time to, like, segue into during this episode, to really kind of get down to it. But the reason that the Raven Guard are fucked by the beginning of the Horus Heresy is because of the Rangdan Xenocide. There were plenty of chapters, there were plenty of legions that were absolutely massively fucked by the Rangdan Xenocides. And there are a bunch of different battles that happened during it, and they're to the level of, like, the Order of the Broken Claw, or the Order of the Broken Griff. Wait, fuck. The Order of the Broken something? Why am I not? Yeah, the Order of the Broken Claw. It wasn't like a chapter full anymore. They had a chapter house and they had something to protect, but there weren't, like, hundreds of them. There were maybe 50.
They're like the precursors to the Tyrannic War veterans.
Yes. Yeah. There's only a couple of them. And the Sable and they're Griffins.
There to train, they're there to protect and train everybody for when the shit hits the fan again. So what I'm picturing, what you're describing is, you know, it's the epitome of human knowledge, you know, the space marine armor and everything they're throwing at everybody. That's probably just one step beyond human tech is what they were fighting. Yeah.
The Sable Griffins didn't get entirely wiped out. The other chapter that was there didn't get entirely wiped out. They actually didn't even get that badly damaged. They were just trapped in the like destroyed fortifications. They were essentially cut off. So, you know, you've got maybe a company that was in the Astropathic Nexus that got fucked. You've got the Order of the Broken Claw getting wiped out. And then you've got whoever died during that last battle. But by the time the Sable Griffins were able to rally and get out of the fortifications and join the fight, the Sons of Horus were already leaving. But the Sons of Horus had wanted to wipe out everybody on the planet, and they hadn't been able to. So it was one of those bittersweet victories for the traitors where they're like, we got the objective. We secured the objective, but we didn't do the damage we wanted to. Our pride is wounded because we didn't wipe them out. But yeah, I like the way that you kind of wound up what the Rangda weapons and knowledge might be. It could just be one step further out from humanity. So next up is the Siege of Chthonia beginning in 006.M31. This conflict is split into several different parts and spans most of the Heresy years, with the resolution finally coming in 014.M31. With that in mind, we'll be covering the first Siege of Chthonia, and we'll return to the planet a few times as we move along this timeline. When the War Master's Rebellion began, his Legion's homeworld was left rather isolated within Imperial space. Remember, Horus was the first to be reunited with the Emperor, and they fought alongside one another in the Great Crusade for about 20 years before any other Primarch had been reunited with their Legion. Chthonia was only a few systems away from Terra. While preparation for the Heresy had been in development for the last few years of the Great Crusade, Horus had done little to fortify the planet at all. In total, only two Sons of Horus chapters and one Wordbearer's company were stationed on the planet to face the Loyalists' wrath. So, at most, 2,100 guys. 2,100 Space Marines. Even though it held such a small garrison force, the Imperium couldn't afford to ignore the planet, as it held the potential as a forward operating base for the traitors. Because of this, Rogel Dorn, the Imperial Fists Primarch, and the chief defense commander of the Loyalists made moves to capture Horus's homeworld. This is before Dorn was named the Praetorian of Terra, which is why I didn't use that title. He's just, at this point, the chief defensive commander of the Loyalist space, of the solar segmentum, essentially. Under the command of the Imperial Fists, Lord Castellan and Vander Garrus, the Imperial Fists 9th and 14th Battalions, Space Wolves 13th Great Company, 3 Adeptus Custodes Solidates, and the Mechanicum Tagamata invaded in 006.M31, starting the first Siege of Terra. So you've got 2 battalions of Imperial Fists, so you've got essentially 1,000 Imperial Fists, and then you have the entire 13th Great Company of Space Wolves. Great Company is a word that the Space Wolves use to mean chapter. So it's an entire chapter. It's 1,000 Space Wolves at the least. So they're taking on 2,100 traitors with roughly 2,000 Space Marines. But then those Space Marines are backed up by 3 units of Adeptus Custodes. So I think a Soldat is 50 Custodes, if I remember correctly. It might be 25, but still, like, Custodes are crazy, so it doesn't really matter. And then the Mechanicum brought a bunch of their crazy, like, war-walking cybernetic death machines, too. So the traitors are a bit outclassed right off the beginning. And I take that back. It's not the 9th and 14th battalions. It's the 9th and 14th chapters. So there's an extra 1,000 Imperial Fists we didn't account for. Sorry about that.
Fucking Imperial Fist, dude.
I'm waiting for Chuck.
Those fucking guys.
Fucking love them. They're the heroes of the Imperium.
Heroes. Goddamn heroes.
Running out like a bunch of bananas, guys.
Finding themselves vastly outmatched, the traitor forces didn't even attempt to meet the Loyalist invasion forces in the void around the planet, allowing the Imperials to land unopposed. Their tactic instead was to focus their defense around the Hive City, Lupercal's Gate, and the Terminal Atlas. The Space Wolves' 13th Great Company overwhelmed the Sons of Horus defenders at Lupercal's gate, claiming First Blood, with the Imperial Fists following in their wake to invade the Hive itself. Garrus's own spearhead from the 456th Company breaking into and claiming the former throne room of the Primarch himself. Garrus, in his eagerness to humble his former allies, had carried out his assault with an unwarranted speed that cost him way more troops than necessary, which the Sons of Horus began to exploit in a growing guerrilla campaign using the dense Hive City to cover their counterattacks as they actually just withdrew. They started to counterattack, but the entire point of their counterattacks was they were withdrawing. The Loyalists realized that the traitors were no longer attempting to hold Lupercal's gate, instead sabotaging key systems which crippled the planet's industrial capacity, infrastructure, and orbital defenses, aiming to deny these assets to the Imperial occupiers, even as they disappeared into Chthonia's underground cavern systems. The first siege ended up ringing as a hollow victory for the Imperium, with Dorne becoming upset with Garrus over the unnecessary losses and many failures that he managed to pull off in his breakneck battle. Although several Sons of Horus High Commanders had been captured and were later transported back to Terra to be publicly executed. So, again, bittersweet. The Imperium technically wins, and they get kind of what they want. They're able to bring a bunch of Sons of Horus commanders back to Terra and execute them in public, which weakens the traitors' stance when it comes to the Imperium at a whole. But the Imperial Fists that were on planet suffered heavy losses, which Dorne isn't happy about. And, sounds, you know, Garrus, yeah.
Sounds like somebody needs a trip to the pain glove.
It's a morale thing, essentially.
It's not your hand, it's your whole body.
I'm going to bring the penis glove.
You don't know about that, Marky? The pain glove?
Nah, what is that? I was assuming it was like a Dune thing.
It's a real thing that the fists have.
Put your hand in the box.
It's a real thing the fists have.
What is it?
It's like a
reset there.
It's like
for the reset button.
Essentially.
What?
Is it next to the prostate? I don't understand.
It can be. You don't know about the pain glove either, Ryan?
No, I'm giving Marky shit. Continue to explain to Marky.
What the fuck?
Holy
picture a sarcophagus that you have to go into.
Right.
And it's locked. And you know how you get those little electrodes that you can put on your body that you can turn up? Right? Yeah. Well, picture your entire body's covered in those.
Okay.
And that's your punishment is that it keeps getting ramped up until you can't take it and you just stay there.
So you just get
not
you're
being
just
able
tased.
To take it.
You just get tased.
More than a tase. It's more than that.
Taser's no joke, man. You ever been tased, Chuck?
And other successor chapters. Other fifth successor chapters do other things to punish themselves in a similar way.
Remember in the movie Princess Bride? Wait. The Princess Bride, and they go down into what do they call it? The Pit of Despair?
Pit of Despair. Yeah.
It's the Pit of Despair.
You guys ever get those? Oh my God. You guys ever get those like cramps in your leg or like in your calf where it just kind of like renders you useless there for a couple seconds?
Dude. I don't even want to talk about that right now.
Just remember, pain is pleasure, and pleasure is pain.
Wow. That's kind of what it's like, but like ramped up to like 20.
It's the day after leg day when you did like 70 lunges and your body's like,
good.
The fuck? No, it doesn't. I can't walk.
I love the way that feels. The only time that I don't like it was when like I sit down to take a shit and I'm like, my legs just give out on me and I just kind of land on the toilet seat. I'm just like, fuck.
That's not fun. I don't like that.
That's the only part I don't like. I like the way it feels to be sore.
I like the way it feels to be sore. I don't like my legs don't work.
You would like the pain glove.
No, I did not enjoy being tased. No, I'd much rather be tased than pepper sprayed, though. That's for sure. So I guess it's not that bad.
The pain glove is being tased and bear sprayed at the same time, all over your body.
You just think of it as like a workout, right? Because like you get tased and like, you know, what is it called?
All of your muscles.
It activates all of your muscles, you know, it's just like you're alive.
If it happens for too long, your muscles will tear themselves apart and break your own bones, by the way.
But
having that much electricity go through you is not good.
You just heal.
And then you just
rinse and repeat.
You just get ripped. I don't know. Pain glove sounds like a good way to work out to me. Dick would have like Marky's, a six pack.
Marky's all about going to that hyperbolic chamber and doing pushups.
Sounds like somebody wants to come wear yellow armor finally.
Yeah, and then you said something about a reset button. And I was like, all right, I don't like the pain glove.
So Cathonia under.
My prostate will have a six pack.
Cathonia under the Imperium.
Oh, sorry.
This next chunk advances a little past where we are in the timeline, but also fits best here and is another great example of how nothing in history takes place in a vacuum. Once the planet had been occupied, Rogel Dorne set about reforming the entire population and infrastructure by loyalist doctrines. Lubrikol's Gate was renamed Traitor's Gate, and all iconography and other traces of the Son of Horus were scourged from the world. Its industrial capacity was shifted in support of the loyalist war effort, and its population became bases for mass recruitment into the Imperial Fists. As a punishment for his failings, Garrus was placed in charge of these tasks and the planet itself. So basically, Garrus got shit detail. He fucked up, and Dorne is like, congratulations, I want you to fix the planet. And Garrus is like, I want to be fighting a war. And Dorne's like, I don't fucking care.
Such a great leader. I love that man.
It didn't take long for the needs of the Imperium's other war zones to pull the many elements of the original invasion force, leaving Garrus only a small garrison mostly made up of the 556th Company. Although he did have the support of some Imperial Army forces, as well as a percentage of the new Imperial Fist recruits he was beginning to pull from the Cathonian population. His occupation was also supported by the Mechanicum forces under Archmagos Archinomus, who was using the planet's industrial capacity to repair damaged Titans. But again, the Mechanicum is repairing Titans. They're not really acting like an occupation force. The Mechanicum is more of a policing force than an occupation force. The Mechanicus is going to protect their own shit, and they're going to give out a couple Skitarii when shit hits the fan. But realistically, they're way more interested in protecting the grounds that they're using to repair Titans than they are to actually helping. Garrus steered into these challenges, however, and he used his punishment detail to start to mold the planet into a loyalist stronghold, relocating the population from the underground caverns to new surface settlements, largely leaving the caverns to the guerrillas, rebuilding its industry back to former levels and investing in greater efforts to recruit new space marines. And he did all of this despite near constant guerrilla warfare attacks. Again, the Sons of Horus and the Word Bearers that were on the planet fled into the caverns, and they're essentially just doing, guerrilla warfare attacks constantly against the Imperial Fist. They're more harassing them than, like, they're not fighting a war, they're being pests, essentially.
They haven't learned their lesson yet.
How many times I got to teach you this lesson, old man?
Oh my God, just don't get back up.
I didn't hear no bell.
Efforts to purge the remaining traitor presence from Cathonia didn't meet with much success. The Sons of Horus garrison forces had withdrawn deep into the planet's caverns, taking up residence near the Cold Core at a bastion named Traitor's Den. They had rallied under the Saturian Boros Krun. The guerrilla forces then began to mass recruit locals as ad hoc initiate space marines of their own. This force would build new underground bases, harassing any forces they encountered and scout out loyalist positions, all while growing into the thousands, although these new initiates were plagued by instability and mutation. These are kind of what we were getting to with Black Shields last episode, where the traitors are making space marines at such a fast rate that the space marines they're making are not stable. And in this particular case, it's the Sons of Horus making space marines in the caverns underneath Cathonia. They probably have some resources down there anyway, because a lot of Cathonian society did live underground before any of this happened. But still, they're not making these new space marines in ideal conditions, and it's causing issues. You know, space marines with three arms, two eyes, you know, gills.
That's why you got to clean the syringes.
Legs. Three legs. Well, all space marines have three legs. Haven't you read the lore?
Always. They're just blessed.
That's why you got to clean the syringes. I like that, Chuck. Their chance to emerge from the darkness came in 007.M31 as the ruined storm spread across the galaxy and cut Chthonia off from the rest of Segmentum Solar. The Sons of Horus and the Word Bearers exploited the following unrest, launching an offensive against the Imperials from the caverns below. While Garrus was able to repel the assault, it cost him greatly, and he sent a request to Dorne for reinforcements. The Primarch was also under pressure and could only spare a few troops, actually sending the Loyalists' 5th Fellowship of the Thousand Sons to join Garrus's forces. The Fellowship was led by Sol Khontep and was made up of survivors of the Burning of Prospero who had thrown themselves at the Emperor's mercy. While they had a chance at redemption fighting against the forces of Horus, they were being overseen by a cadre of Sisters of Silence led by Abrabul Milo. Garrus also didn't have much trust to place in these twice traitor Marines and stationed them far away from other Imperial forces at Pharos Obscurus, a Lumen Tower, their standing orders being to hunt down and eliminate the traitors in the cavern systems as they could. Now, this is one of those examples of another set of black shields, this time being actual full-fledged Marines from a fallen legion who had essentially turned on their own Primarch.
So are these, like these other events that we're talking about right now, are these like short stories? Were these whole books? Was it kind of like a collection of all those things? They're just like key points that happened in the Horus Heresy?
Yeah, it's kind of a collection of all the things that happened. The Siege of Chthonia is actually a relatively long book, but it's presented as like instead of covering the Siege of Chthonia as an entire episode itself, essentially is what we could do. We're talking about it in chunks as it fits into the rest of the timeline. Because a lot of these events, a lot of these books don't deal with, like, it's not like book 7 is immediately followed by book 8. It's like book 7 deals with events that happen during book 8, 9, and 10. And then finish, but things that started in book 9 are also happening in book 53. And that's the way a lot of the Horus Heresy books work. So as we're kind of covering the timeline, we're going relatively close to the year. We're talking about the Imperial occupation in more detail and going further in the timeline just because it doesn't make sense to talk about the first siege and then talk about the beginning of the occupation and then stop and then talk about the second half of the occupation and then stop and then talk about the third part. Yeah, we might as well talk about it all at once and then jump back a little bit. But yeah, over the next few years, Garrus would be reinforced by other Loyalist survivors from the Battle of Tolaron and Beta Garmin, as well as Space Marines from the Shattered Legions. Chthonia would also become a position from which the Imperium would be able to launch strikes into traitor-held space in the galactic south. And then in 11.M31, a warband of surviving salamanders came to the planet, only to be revealed as disguised Alpha Legion agents. While the Loyalists were able to defeat these agents, it wasn't before they had been able to deliver supplies and other reinforcements to the traitor guerrilla forces still operating under the surface of the world. By 12.M31, a growing number of scattered survivors from the traitor warbands had managed to gather at Chthonia, many fleeing the passage of angels. As the guerrilla war dragged on, the Imperial Fists had continued to recruit more and more troops from the native population, leading to an ironic turn of events. By the time of the second siege, the Imperial Fists had more than a third of their force being made up of by Astartes native to Chthonia, a number which far outpaced the natives left in the Sons of Horus as a whole, who had been recruiting from other planets. I want to say Chuck brought this up a couple of episodes ago. A lot of Imperial Fists are from Chthonia.
I fucking love it. Yeah.
So,
because they know who to side with. They know Dad is right.
They know who occupies their planet, and they're being given an option at a better life. Like, I get what you're saying, but at a certain point, you're generally the population center of a planet, like the civilian population center, has a tendency to just go with whoever won. Not because Space Daddy is better. It's just Space Daddy's in charge.
Because he's better. That's why he's in charge. Got it.
Right.
So do you kind of understand how that fits in better, Marky? overlaps a bunch of this stuff, essentially.
Also, kind of, I don't know if I forgot or not, but I didn't realize that the Space Marine Legions were essentially recruiting humans from other, well, obviously humans, people from other planets to become Astartes. Was that pretty normal?
Up until 006.M31, Horus would have been getting replenishment Sons of Horus Astartes from Chthonia. But as soon as the Imperium took it in 006 as their own, he was no longer able to get units from his homeworld. So now when he's replenishing during the heresy, when he's replenishing, he's taking replenishments from the planets he conquers as the traitor Horus. So he's no longer the loyalist. So that's how that happened. Essentially, the Sons of Horus, you know, the Chthonians and the Sons of Horus are continuing to die because they're the veteran troops. They're the ones that are seeing the most action. That, you know, the longer, if you put anything on a long enough timeline, the survivability drops to zero statement from Fight Club is paying true. And since they can't get new troops from Chthonia, they're taking them from wherever they can. The Imperial Fists, on the other hand, are special. The Imperial Fists do take units from their own planet, but they can only recruit the population of their homeworld is not super robust. So they kind of take recruits from everywhere. The Imperial Fists essentially recruit from anything in the Segmentum Solar.
Their main places are Terra, Necromunda, and Inwit. So think about all the gangers and stuff from the Necromunda game. The biggest and strongest ones can become Imperial Fists.
Goliaths, because Goliaths are like vat grown and mutated, but
Not mutants. Mutants must burn.
But yeah, so the Imperial Fists are kind of a special case because they recruit from essentially Segmentum Solar, if you want to put it that way. And the reason that the Imperial Fists don't recruit from Chthonia in the 41st millennia is because Chthonia doesn't exist anymore. We'll get there. But during this time, it was a third of Garrus's forces. It wasn't a third of the Imperial Fists, but Garrus's forces at this point are probably pretty big. You know, we at one point had talked about you could probably make 1,000 Space Marines in a 6-month period. You know, they have to be trained. They're green. They're not ready. But if you can make 1,000 in 6 months, that means every year you can produce 2,000, or maybe you can even make them a little bit faster than that. So you might have 5,000 Space Marines ready in a 3-year period. So in a 6 or 8 year occupation of a world, you're raising quite a few Space Marines. Even if you're sending off half of them to other battlefields, you still have a relatively large chunk. Next, we're going to go to the Battle of Cygnus Prime in 006.M31. Well before the Battle of Ishtvan III, Horus had used his powers as War Master to move the Loyalist legions about, setting traps designed to either destroy them outright or leave them too bogged down to assist the Emperor. With the Blood Angels, Horus took the advice of Erebus and put a plan into motion that would turn their gene seed flaw, the Red Thirst, against them, hoping it would cause their Primarch Sanguinius and his legion to fall to Khorne. However, within the camp of the Ruinous Powers themselves, not all were aligned with this plan. While Erebus and the Keeper of Secrets, Kyrus, wished to convert the angel in his legion, the bloodthirster Ka-Banda, is Ka-Banda the way you pronounce that, Marky? I know you, do you have him? Ka-Banda. He's one of the big bloodthirsters. I think he's still around. I think he's still a model you can buy. Maybe he's not one of the named ones you can buy.
It sounds familiar. Amanda.
Yeah, here he is.
Ka-Banda.
This dude.
Oh, I do not have him.
He's Forge World.
And he's also almost $400. There's a reason I don't have him.
So Ka-Banda. We'll just go with Ka-Banda. If you know a lot about the Bloodthirsters and we're pronouncing some of these names wrong, sorry. The Bloodthirster Ka-Banda and the Dark Apostle Tanis Creed saw the Primarch as too loyal and instead just wanted to outright destroy him. Then they would work to corrupt the reeling Blood Angels and bring them under the War Master's banner. So essentially, Erebus and the Keeper of Secrets, Kyrus, wanted to corrupt Sanguinius and then use Sanguinius to convert the Legion. Kalbanda and the Dark Apostle, Tanis Creed, Dark Apostle being a rank, a chaplain rank inside the Word Bearers, wanted to destroy the Primarch and then use the loss of the Primarch to basically convert the Blood Angels, because the Blood Angels would be all fucked up if they managed to kill the Primarch. While the two had also been good friends during the Crusade itself, Horus also realized that Sanguinius would become a great rival to his own power base, and that was another point of contention in this whole plan. So the third side of this, like, will they, won't they, was Horus really liked Sanguinius and wanted Sanguinius because they were friends, but he also understood how powerful Sanguinius was. And he was like, Sanguinius is the Primarch who can probably challenge me to lead the heresy if he becomes on my side. There were a lot of reasons for Horus not to have Sanguinius around during the beginning of the heresy, essentially.
Because even though most of us hate to admit it, but Sanguinius probably the most powerful one, with no other weird witchery attached to him.
The three that easily could have been War Master were Horus, Sanguinius, and Dorne. Like, hands down. And
is Dorne that powerful, and probably, or is he just that order, much of a tactician?
It's just because of his tactics and the size of the Legion he ended up commanding, essentially.
Mm, yeah. Because I would say, like, Dorne and Gilliman are pretty much on par, right? It's just that Dorne...
Gilliman becomes powerful during the heresy.
Okay.
Dorne, if that makes any sense. Yeah. The basics of authority and power that Gilliman has comes from the Imperium Secundus, and the Imperium Secundus happens during the heresy.
Would you think more of like Gilliman is like an offensive tactician, where Dorne is like a defensive tactician? Is that fair to say?
I would say that Dorne was more measured.
Yeah, he can handle both. It's just Gilliman, I think, is more of a... I wouldn't say practical, but he's like over practice. Cause like, you read it in the books, he over practices doing things, where Dorne mm-hmm. will be more like, this works. We know it works. We'll fix it as it's happening if we have to.
Dorne is more flexible, practical. Yeah. Dorne is a more practical leader.
Dorne's Patton.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm. I was trying to think of movie characters to compare them each to. I would put Dorne kind of on the Maximus Aurelius level from Gladiator. Mm-hmm. And I would put Gilliman as Leonidas from the 300. Gilliman is going to run forward and slaughter a bunch of people because it's the glory of battle. Dorne mm-hmm. is going to do the thing that's proper and correct for his army. Essentially.
Okay.
Like, you know, I mean, Leonidas is kind of a little bit more brash and a little, you know what I mean? Right.
You
see the comparison.
Yeah. I just didn't see Maximus Aurelius like, lead any army really. So it's more
if you
just
think
like,
of the very beginning of the movie, yeah. which
think
is kind
of
what I was thinking
movie,
of.
Like he is the general of Rome. He leads all the, I think about the end of the movie when he's dying.
Yeah.
Everybody just snaps to when he gives his orders. Like, there's no fucking question.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. Yeah, when he kills the emperor, everybody's just like, oh, this is actual boss.
So picture that scene, but Dorne actually killing the emperor, and everybody would have been like, yeah, okay, we're done.
Yeah, I'm trying to think if I can draw more parallels, but I think I pick up what you're putting down.
It's a little, I mean...
I know it's a little off the rails, but it's like when the emperor, I know we talked about before, but like when the emperor decided who to make War Master, it was kind of tough for him because it's like he got Horus, who's all rounded
mm-hmm.
and most the Primarchs like him. He got Sanguinius, very well rounded, and he's like a Primarch that they show with more of a heart.
Yeah,
you know, kind of like.
And Sanguinius is also ridiculously powerful. Like Sanguinius takes on Titans.
He's Emperor level powerful. He's like off the charts.
But he's a mutant, so people don't respect him as much because
of his wings. But then you have like Dorne, who's like the third choice, where it's like, oh, the military will snap to and has no problems, but mm-hmm. he's not always very gentle as a diplomat.
Right.
Where Gilman is more gentle as a diplomat. He's more wordy, more understanding, where Dorne's more rigid. So it's like
Okay, I see. Yeah. So you could think of Gilman more as like a wartime politician, where Dorne would be like a general.
Yes.
A wartime general.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
And Horace would be the ever-present statesman. Right? Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, Horace was the best. If things hadn't happened the way they did, if the wheels hadn't fallen off, Horace was the best choice, because Horace was like the presidential figure.
Yeah.
He's a little bit of everything. And Sanguinius would have been, if you want to think about it this way, Horace is the charismatic, well-rounded one. Sanguinius is the nuclear weapon. Dorne is the general, and Gilliman is the hungry politician. Mm-hmm. So out of those choices, the best choice is Horace. And that's what the Emperor came to. Not only that, but like the Horace and Emperor had a very different relationship than the Emperor and any other Primarchs.
They were actually more of a son father because of how much time he spent with them.
They had spent with each other. And most of the Primarchs
A lot of them were jealous of that.
Really respected Horace, but were incredibly jealous of him at the same time. Horace dispatched the Word Bearer's chaplain, the Dark Apostle, Tanis Creed, with orders for the Blood Angels to cleanse the Cygnus Cluster, which Horace claimed was under the influence of the Xenos tyrants known as the Nephilim. Unaware of the coming betrayal, Sanguinius followed these orders and headed straight into the teeth of Horus's trap, a trap which the War Master had further baited, claiming that the Nephilim had technology which could cure the Red Thirst. And so the Blood Angels, a small force of the Imperial Army, the Legio Cybernetica, and 3,420 Word Bearers under Tanis Creed made for this conflict zone. Meanwhile, Horus had sent the Serpent Lodge priest Bruja to unleash a demonic horde in system, which served as a vessel for the Keeper of Secrets, Kryas, to enter the Materium. So I found out more about the Nephilim at one point, Marky. The Nephilim were like kind of big whale creatures.
Oh, really?
The White Scars book about Jakhatai, about the formation of the Legion, very beginning of the book deals with the White Scars fighting the Nephilim. So I made a mental note because I know that you like them. Yeah, it's one of the only times where the Nephilim are actually in a book as a Xenos species fighting Space Marines. So I made a mental note to go back and re-listen to it, because I know that you had you had asked more about the Nephilim.
Yeah, for sure.
They're basically like big whales, and they kind of like whale humans. Like,
aren't they like super hyper intelligent, something like that?
Are they like, are they like Mr. Krabs' like daughter?
No, I was thinking the dude from Lilo and Stitch, the big whale shark dude from Lilo and Stitch,
like Mr. Krabs' daughter. Oh, what
is
her name?
I haven't seen enough SpongeBob to know that. But essentially, the Nephilim can like psychically control populations. So they're crazy. There's not a lot on them, but there's enough that I was like, oh, this is interesting. We'll circle back when we do our Xenos. Our next Xenos minor races, we'll retouch on the Nephilim, because I found more
definitely an interesting one. Yeah.
Yeah, I read this book that you were about to talk about.
Yep.
This is the book where I was like, wow, Sanguinius is an actual fucking badass angel.
No, Sanguinius, and he gets even crazier in the Siege of Terra with some of the shit that he does. As soon as they arrived in the Cygnus system, the Blood Angels witnessed a strange cosmic phenomenon as a shadowy membrane covered the entire system and cut them off from any withdrawal, while the planet Phoros itself was fractured with demonic runes. The Loyalists attempted to search for human survivors on the planet of Holst, only to be swarmed by creatures of the derelict Rex in orbit. Eventually, the corpulent world was the target for an exterminatus. Sanguinius ordered further expeditions deeper into the Cygnus worlds of Sulctrum and Talok. On Sulctrum, the 24th Blood Angels Company under Captain Nakur and the Cybernetica under Archmagos Dominia Shral investigated the mostly empty world, but for the vast fires left unchecked and the wreckage of the defense frigate Stark Dagger. It was then that the Imperial forces faced the demonic forces directly, being forced to conduct a fighting withdrawal. At Talok, the 11th and 94th companies under Malgrin became entrapped by demonic forces of their own after they had ventured deep into the underground. The resulting desperate retreating battle lasted for 8 hours. In both cases, Sanguinius ordered localized orbital bombardments, although this achieved little in the end. The shit really hit the fan at Cygnus Prime, however, when the raw power of the warp was unleashed on the fleet. Almost instantly, many of the non-Astartes crew went mad, forcing the Space Marines to intervene and detain them, as those that got away turned on one another with murderous intent. The chronometers of the fleet read the insane and impossible date of 666.666.666.M31. And in the midst of all of this madness, the Keeper of Secrets, Kyrus the Perverse, sent an image of itself directly into Sanguinius's chamber. The challenge to attack had been made clear, and the Angel of the Ninth Legion responded in kind. However, the Blood Angel's fleet was soon ambushed by an armada of corpse vessels, which tore a heavy toll from the Imperium forces and avoid battle. I love the idea of like entire spaceships turned into zombies.
Zombie crews just doing their thing.
I imagine even the outside of the ships are like all fucking zombified.
So the 666.666 wasn't the actual date, right? Date. Warp virus.
Yep. It was 006.M31.
Welcome to hell.
Right? Yep. What do you call it? Event Horizon type shit. Yep.
During the Void conflict, Athena? The Imperial Army Admiral Athena Decade, succumbed to the insanity that plagued her forces and plunged the Dark Angel's flagship Red Tear into the planet itself. Sanguinius managed to wrestle the system away and steer his flagship into a rough emergency landing, and then unleash the fury of his legion upon Cygnus Prime. He then personally led his elite in an assault on Kyrus's palace, known as the Cathedral of the Mark, while around him, his blood angels took on the vast demonic legions, and now revealed traitorous word bearers and uncountable numbers of chaos cultists. As soon as they land, the word bearers go from being friends to being enemies. In orbit, the heavy cruiser Scarlet Liberty couldn't bring its guns to bear on the cathedral, as its sensors and targeting array slipped off it or became jammed within seconds of finding it and locking on. And so below, the chapter master Raldoran and Apothecary Maros led the assault at the Primarch's side. As they neared the palace of Cryus the Perverse, a massive demon the color of dried blood rose to meet Sanguinius. It was Kabanda, a greater demon of Khorne, who attempted to sway Sanguinius to the cause of Khorne. However, the Lord of the Blood Angels could not be tempted and attacked the Bloodthirster, dealing the demon a vicious wound in the opening engagement. The demon then counterattacked and ripped the Primarch to the ground, crushing his legs in the coils of his whip. With Sanguinius then forced to watch helplessly as Kabanda slaughtered his way through the Blood Angels, killing over 500 of them, feeding the malignant energy of their deaths into the Rage Fire, a device that worked to corrupt the very planet itself. This caused a massive psychic trauma, which knocked Sanguinius unconscious and unlocked something dark within him and the members of his legion.
Is this the Black Rage? I thought that was the...
Nope, no, this is like a deeper, worse level of the Red Thirst, essentially.
There's the artwork of the book, man. It's such a quick
and Sanguinius fighting each other.
And when you read Kabanda. It, you're like, damn, that fight's over already. Like, he just literally bitch slapped him and walked away.
Oh yeah, no, the demon is fucking power. Yeah, this is two titans like fighting each other. It really is. Like, and it only takes one bad hit from one or the other to knock the other out.
So
the power levels on these guys are well over 9,000.
Kabanda is like what's his name? I keep forgetting his name, Chuck.
Carson Scarbrand?
Like Scarbrand.
Yeah. He's a greater bloodthirster.
He's like a general of bloodthirsters, basically.
Oh, shit. Okay.
Yeah. Scarbrand
is almost like a exiled bloodthirster kind of dude.
Yeah. So Scarbrand pissed off Khorne, and Khorne blew his wings off, and he flicked him across the warp and blew his wings off.
Yeah. Like, this dude's like that epic level.
So he's like a Scarbrand, but a little more well collected.
Yeah, not punished. Yeah.
He's a functioning
functioning general. Bloodthirster.
He didn't spend any time in the pain glove.
And Scarbrand at this point is kind of like, if you could say a such thing as a renegade demon, he's kind of a renegade demon.
Yeah, he does his own thing. He's a demon with a bad attitude. He's like a teenager.
Yep. Which is weird to say, a demon with a bad attitude. The dark rage that consumed the Legion was born from the fall of their lord and the butchery of their brothers, and it drove them into the demonic hordes. Deep in the berserker fury of the Red Thirst, consumed by their rage, the Blood Angels, led by Nasir Amit, massacred their space wolf allies before tearing into the human cultists and then the word bearers. The line between friend and foe completely lost. A group of former Blood Angel librarians, led by Makanai Kano, were able to resist the Red Thirst and used a method forbidden by the Council of Nakia to reach Sanguinius and reawaken their Primarch. Once back on his feet, and despite his injuries, the Primarch of the Blood Angels once again smashed into Kabada, pulling him into a second round of combat, where he eventually banished the Bloodthirster back to the warp. So in their second fight, Sanguinius did not lose. As they fought all across Cygnus Prime, the planet was completely purged by the rampaging Blood Angels. And it wasn't until every last corn demon and cultist was slain that they regained their senses. Even so, Cryris the Perverse, the remaining demon on the planet, still hoped to turn Sanguinius and offered the Primarch a deal. If he gave himself into the Ragefire device, his legion would be cured of the Red Thirst forever. It was at this point that Sanguinius decided to sacrifice himself for his sons. But just as he was about to step into the rage fire, giving himself over fully, Maros beat him to it. Failing at his mission, Cryus was banished back to the warp, while Maros was transformed into the Red Angel. We'll talk about the Red Angel later. The wrath of the Blood Angels left a stain across the minds of the survivors, who were able to raise the red tear from the planet itself. And Cygnus Prime forever became a place of darkness in their memories. They then faced the traitors of Task Force Yekthedon, which had been charged with keeping them contained in the Cygnus Cluster. However, they were able to escape, although the Task Force did manage to destroy several of the Legion ships and the Astartes on them.
Damn, so it was almost like a Black Rage before the Black Rage?
Yes, it was like a Black Rage, but yeah,
Legion-wide, yeah.
Yeah. And the entire Legion lost their shit except for the librarians.
Damn. And you gotta remember, Marky, the apothecary in the book, they talk about him quite a bit. He doesn't act like a normal apothecary. You know, normal apothecary is kind of like, what, you know, mid-range kind of guy. Oh, I'm gonna fix this dude over here. No, he's in like Mark III armor, charging forward like he's a captain all the time, like leading the way.
Yeah. Maros is kind of a one-man army.
Yeah, the dude's a badass, and then he sacrifices himself
before he becomes the Red Angel.
He sacrifices himself.
Red Angel bad? Red Angel good? What are we talking here? I've never actually heard of the Red Angel.
Marky.
Oh, come on! How are you gonna do that to me, man? Jesus Christ!
He'll come back up.
That's one of those cliffhangers.
Yep.
Essentially, sacrificed himself, right?
Yeah, and he became something different. Gotcha. He became what Cryus wanted Sanguinius to become.
Gotcha.
Now, whether or not it happened in the same way, we'll leave for later.
What I was going to get at, too, is he becomes like a mopey demon, which is hilarious.
Yep. Mopey?
Yeah. We'll talk about the Red Angel. It's coming.
He's like an Eeyore demon.
In the aftermath of the... God damn it, Chuck. In the aftermath of the Battle of Cygnus Prime, Horus flew into a fury, having for the first time tasted true defeat. Unlike at Ishtvan 3 and Ishtvan 5, where he had emerged victorious, and unlike Kalth, where the word bearers still achieved their ultimate objective despite the tactical loss, at Cygnus Prime nothing had been achieved. The Blood Angels had overcome all that had been set before them, and Sanguinius remained true to the Emperor. In his own echoes of that rage, Erebus chastised Horus for the plan's failure and was rewarded by the War Master flaying the skin off his face with his own hands. Can you imagine somebody tearing the skin off your face?
I fucking love it.
And this doesn't kill Erebus, by the way. Just so we're clear.
Oh, so he's real pretty.
Yeah. The war in the Cygnus cluster spanned 7 planets and 15 moons in total and raged into 007.M31, crossing over with the Battle of Kalth and the coming of the Runestorm. Its resolution setting a determined Sanguinius against his one favored brother Horus, a consequence which would echo and build across the rest of the conflict that came to a head during the Siege of Terra. And that's where we'll wrap up part one of The Coming Storm.
I hate these cliffhangers, Ryan. You really got to stop doing them, dude.
I'm good at them. I'm getting better at them.
Tune in next week for your next episode of...
Damn it.
I'm going to love it. Look at that photo that you have of that smiling dude. Like, wouldn't you want to follow that, Marky? Look how happy he is. That's pre-Davin.
Pre-Davin.
Look at that guy.
There's something going on with
Beastie Dude.
The talons of... This may be an AI-generated picture.
Yeah.
Because the talons of Horus look really funky, and the, like, wolf pelts on his back look a little too anime-ish. Anyway, it was a cool picture of Horus, so I brought it up. It's one of those things that the more you look at it, the more you're like, I think this might be AI.
Yeah, they look like the fingernails on one of those dudes from the Guinness Book of World Records.
Right? Ripley's Believe It or Not.
Yeah, right. This guy hasn't cut his nails his entire life.
So we will continue with our little series called The Coming Storm in a part two and a part three. As I mentioned, there are definitely battles that we want to pull out and talk about specifically in their own mini series. Whether or not we'll cover them as a quick portion of the timeline and then go back to them, or whether or not we will cover a little bit more of the timeline in a part two and then break out into a specific deep dive, we're not sure yet. But you guys have more Horus Heresy content to look forward to. If you want to get into contact with us about any of our episodes or the show itself, you can do that through email at underthehiveofmadness@gmail.com.
You can also join our community on Discord. There we talk about the lore, hobby, tactics of Warhammer 40K, plus other things such as Warhammer Age of Sigmar, Magic the Gathering, role-playing games, video games, and much more. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, or at our website, underthehiveofmadness.com. Spelling and links should be in the show notes below.
Help the podcast grow by liking and reviewing us wherever you get your podcast fix. Our home is Spotify, but you can find us on Apple, Google, Audible, and many more. You can also support us on Patreon. That is www.patreon.com/underthehiveofmadness. All Patreon members get access to a video podcast so you can see our beautiful smiling faces and hear the times that my tongue rebels and Marky says off-colored shit that makes me dissolve into coughing fits of laughter. All Patreon levels also get access to a quarterly painting contest. If you want to get involved with that, head over to our Discord. Plus, we have started to do giveaways. So if you're interested in winning some monthly merch and some other cool things, head on over and check all that stuff out. Mama Kaz's Noodle House, home of the spiciest dishes in the hive. Voted the best ramen house in the Carcosan sector, third year in a row by Intergalactic Trucker Magazine. Grab a bowl of Liz Gizzard ramen or try their new Frost Bat Fried Rice. Make it a meal and wash it down with an ice-cold Arrogant Squig Ale. Only 5 creds.
Ah, that's a spicy!
Your source for the freshest news on the Pirate Vox waves. We are the true sound of rebellion, 665.66 UHMR Chemrat Radio. Reminding all of you Chemrats, Hive Mice, and Sump Ghoulies to keep those dials fixed right here. Same ratty frequency for a dose of the same ratty ass attitude.
In shadows deep, where fears are sown, four-armed emperors reign alone. Claws of darkness, eyes aglow. Beware their grasp, where nightmares grow. Motherfuckers.
we
are 4 arms, 3 dicks, 1 ball. Marky signing off.
Wow. Remember, a 1 is a 1, and sometimes it's a 20.